parades, and police as Communist China celebrates its 70th birthday.
They banned flying kites and even homing pigeons to make sure that the skies were secure.
And Secretary of State Mike Pompeo took part in President Trump's July phone call with Ukraine's president.
It shows that a whole new level of administration officials were involved.
Plus, the fourth quarter begins today. This is What's News from The Wall Street Journal. I'm Kim Gittleson. Let's get started. Now, before we take a look at today's celebrations in Beijing for the 70th anniversary of Communist China, here's what you missed. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was one of the people who listened in on a July 25th phone call between President Trump and Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. That's according to a senior State Department official. From Washington, Sadie Gurman has more.
And it's particularly significant because it brings the State Department closer into the Democrats' impeachment inquiry, which is ongoing on Capitol Hill. Pompeo has been out in the front answering questions or declining to answer questions about this whistleblower complaint without ever revealing that he, in fact, was aware of the call and was on the call. So it's an interesting development.
Mr. Pompeo, who's in Europe this week, said last week that to his knowledge, actions by the State Department officials had been, quote, entirely appropriate and consistent with administration efforts to improve relations with Ukraine. Sadie says that the fact that Mr. Pompeo listened in on the call is important to the impeachment inquiry, which is focused on President Trump's dealings with Ukraine.
Well, it shows that a whole new level of administration officials were involved in the handling of the whistleblower complaint and had firsthand knowledge of the call that took place, and raises new questions about how government officials handled whistleblowers' concerns.
We report that the scrutiny of the call with Ukraine has prompted a wider examination of efforts by the Trump administration to engage foreign leaders in assisting with issues important to the president. And here's a proposal that could potentially end, or at least dramatically shrink, one of the largest and most complex pieces of litigation the U.S. has ever seen. It has to do with the thousands of lawsuits against pharmaceutical companies that manufacture opioids. According to internal documents and a person familiar with the matter, Endo International, Johnson & Johnson, and other pharma companies facing lawsuits related to the crisis are considering joining Purdue Pharma's bankruptcy filing. Sarah Randazzo explains.
Yeah, so it'd be a pretty novel idea where the companies themselves, which include Johnson & Johnson, Endo, Teva, and some others, wouldn't themselves be filing for bankruptcy, but they'd essentially be piggybacking on Purdue Pharma's existing bankruptcy and contributing money to the same fund that Purdue is giving money to. And the idea would be to get a relief from the bankruptcy court that would alleviate all of the opioid cases against them. So they see this as a potentially creative way to get a court order saying this is a global settlement, it gets you out of all these lawsuits, and essentially achieves a true global resolution.
A few caveats. The idea is still in its early stages and no dollar figures have yet been discussed. And the concept would need buy-in from Purdue Pharma and its owners, the Sackler family, as well as a critical mass of state attorneys general and local municipalities suing the companies. Purdue Pharma declined to comment. And some good news. New York City's poverty rate has fallen to a historic low. According to census data, the city's poverty rate fell by 3.6% between 2013 and 2018 to 17.3%. That's its lowest level since the 1970s, and it follows similar trends across the country. Now, our main story this morning. That was the scene earlier today as China's President Xi Jinping presided over a military parade celebrating the 70th anniversary of Communist China. Speaking after a playing of the national anthem and a 70-gun salute, Mr. Xi said the founding of the communist-ruled state had reversed China's tragic fate of being, quote, bullied and humiliated for more than a century. Instead, he said China was now on the road to a, quote, great rejuvenation. Jeremy Page is in Beijing, and he watched it all unfold. So, Jeremy, can you give us a sense of the scale of these celebrations? I was looking at some of the images. They're pretty impressive.
Yes, I mean, they're on a massive scale. I mean, the sort of whole country comes to a bit of a halt, and they've gone to some fairly extraordinary measures to ensure that everything happened correctly and smoothly. And there were all sorts of regulations that were imposed over the last few days and weeks. They banned flying kites and even homing pigeons to make sure that the skies were secure. For, I think, among other things, they're going to release 70,000 doves and 70,000 coloured balloons. You also had a whole load of military aircraft flying overhead. It was a civilian parade which involved about 100,000 people, some 70,000 floats.
Wow. So quite a celebration. I mean, what does this sort of demonstration show when it comes to Mr. Xi's hold on power, I guess?
Well, it's clearly designed to show that he is very firmly in control. You know, he takes center stage for the entire thing. You know, he made a short speech from on top of the Tiananmen Gate, which is where Mao Zedong declared the establishment of the People's Republic of China back in 1949. So it's very sort of redolent with historical and political significance that he stands in the same place to make the speech, and then he goes down onto Tiananmen Square and gets in a limousine which has a sort of like a sunroof, and he stands up in this vehicle and is driven past the assembled troops. So, you know, it's a pretty vivid demonstration of the personal power that he's imbued with, and that's very important for him. But at the same time, he needs to project this image of strength, because at the moment there are all these challenges to his authority, and it's always very hard to tell how strong he really is, because one doesn't know what's going on behind the scenes. But what we do know is that he's facing some formidable challenges, both in terms of the economy, with the U.S. trade war now exacerbating an economic slowdown that was already underway.
What about Hong Kong? Have we seen anything happen there today? And how big of a challenge are the protests happening there for President Xi?
Well, today, I think, the pattern in Hong Kong is that the worst clashes, the most violent clashes, have been at night. They have also mostly been at the weekend over the last few weeks. But the protesters made it clear that they were going to try to stage more protests today, knowing that this was this hugely politically significant anniversary. And likewise, Hong Kong authorities, the police, have made it clear that they are going to crack down very hard on any behavior they consider illegal. So I expect we're going to see the worst clashes later on this evening.
So these celebrations end today. What next? What happens after the sort of parades are cleared and the confetti's put away?
Well, in a way, everyone breathes a bit of a sigh of relief. There's been an immense amount of time and energy which has been invested in trying to ensure that this goes off without a hitch and projects the right image. And, especially that the protests in Hong Kong don't overshadow it in some way. So, once I think we've got through the rest of the day, things in a way sort of go back to normal, certainly in the mainland. But in Hong Kong, the protests will continue. And, if they follow the pattern they have over the last few weeks, then we'll see more protests this weekend. And, that crisis is not going to end in the foreseeable future.
You can find our full coverage, including a slideshow of the 70th anniversary events and the reaction in Hong Kong, up on WSJ.com. On to markets. Yesterday was the last day of the third quarter. We talked a bit about it in our afternoon show. The S&P 500 closed with a 19% gain for the year to date. That's its best performance since 1997. So what does the last quarter of the year have in store? Here's Paul Davies with more.
So it's going to be another quarter where it's very difficult for investors to work out how and where to make money. The stock market is still near record highs, but it's not done brilliantly this quarter. At the same time, bond yields across the board are heading lower and lower again, as there are worries about the economy globally, in the US and globally. And then we've got two pretty important central bank meetings coming up in October. Right at the end of the month, we have the Federal Reserve. And then just before that, we've got the European Central Bank, the final meeting of President Mario Draghi before he hands over to Christine Lagarde as the incoming president. And their real challenge is to try and get European governments to start spending some money.
And here's what else we're paying attention to today. U.S. authorities alleged yesterday that a tour guide for Chinese visitors to California was also secretly working for Chinese intelligence. They unsealed a criminal complaint involving a double agent, dead drops, and bundles of cash. Here's David Anderson, the U.S. District Attorney for Northern California.
The defendant's name is Xu Hua, also known as Edward Pong. Pong is alleged to be a secret agent of the NSS. Pong is alleged to have delivered classified national security information of the United States from the United States to the PRC. To most of the world, Pong presented himself as a 56-year-old sightseeing and tour operator living in Haywood, California. He has a registered business operating in the Bay Area. Through this business, he has arranged tours for Chinese tourists and students through a company called U.S. Tour and Travel.
An attorney for Mr. Peng didn't immediately respond to requests for comment. We report the case underscores the U.S.'s increasing willingness to confront China's spy agency head on. Finally, some heartwarming news to end the morning. Many of us can't fathom donating even one organ, but we've got a profile out today of the rare Good Samaritans who've donated two. Over the past 25 years, only 47 people in the U.S. have donated more than one organ. 43 out of those 47 donated a kidney and part of their liver. One of them, a rabbi living in New Jersey, told us that even though it took him 3 or 4 months to fully recover after the donation, if he could do it again, he would do it tomorrow morning. That's what's news from the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.